Hey, before we get going, I want to give you a word from our sponsor, Mack Weldon. I actually taped this episode from the road, and when I got there where I was going, I put on some underwear, and then I was like, wow, there's a hole in these underwear. So I put on another pair of underwear, and those also had a hole in them. And that was when I realized I was living in the past underwear-wise, and I wanted to bring my underwear game into the future. So I went to Mack Weldon. They've got smart design, premium fabrics, and the best part is a great, simple shopping experience. It feels so easy to restock your socks and underwear, which used to be a sort of a boring stocking stuffer, but they've now turned into a top-of-the-line gift. I really recommend checking it out. It makes a great present this holiday season. And the best part is, if you go to mackweldon.com, that's mackweldon.com, and put in long form as your promo code, you'll get 20% off. You'll also support the show. Thanks, Mack Weldon. Our second sponsor is The Message from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply, one of my favorite podcast networks. It's basically an 8-episode podcast series in which they follow the story of a team of cryptologists at a research think tank called Cypher as they try to decode a message received from outer space 70 years ago. It's really excellent. I recommend checking it out. I like this format, 8-episode series. The Message from GE Podcast Theater and Panoply. You can get it in iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, let's move on. Hello and welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Aaron Lammer. I'm here with Evan Ratliff and Max Linsky. Hello.
Hey, you guys.
Hey, Aaron. I understand this is some kind of special episode.
It's a special episode. What makes it special? What makes it different than other episodes? This episode is coming to you direct from Miami Beach, Florida. The Standard Hotel brought me down there to interview people at the Miami Book Fair, which they sponsored. This interview was my favorite one I did.
Who was it?
Chip Kidd. Do you know who Chip Kidd is, Max?
I do. Okay. I didn't before, but now I do. And you actually call out in the interview how
I make fun of you,
uninformed.
Yeah, but I don't. Yeah. But not by name. Out of respect.
You said one of my co-hosts
could be anyone.
One of my co-hosts didn't know who you are. The other one wrote a book that you designed.
Totally ambiguous.
If you hadn't given it away just now, they never would have known.
Chip Kidd is the most well-known book designer, I think, maybe ever. He designs many books that are deep in our cultural memory. He also has written a lot about design. He's written novels. He wrote a TED book that's about designing book covers recently. He wrote it's sort of about first impressions, and he wrote a children's graphic design book. He is all over the place doing really interesting things. I was really psyched to get him on the show. It's not the normal guest we have on, but I think it actually touches on a lot of stuff that's quite relevant.
It also seemed like you guys were having a really good time.
I had good rapport with him. He's a lovely man.
It seemed like generally Florida agreed with you.
It did agree with me. I could spend a lot of time in Florida.
Evan, I got this text from Aaron at one point when he was down there that just said, "Gotta say, I kind of dig Florida."
I do.
Yeah. He wasn't in Jacksonville.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably unfair to say that you dig Florida entirely on the basis of spending 3 nights at the Standard Spa, which has a world-class hammam and a pool where you can listen to the music underwater.
Wow. Speaking of the Standard Hotel, who are our sponsors this week?
Well, our sponsor, as always, is MailChimp. If you have a business that sends emails, you should be sending them with MailChimp. 8 million others already are. But in this specific episode's case, I want to send a double thank you out to the Standard Spa in Miami Beach. You can go to standardhotels.com to learn a bit more about them. They have some stuff from the fair. It's cool. They actually run their website kind of like a magazine. They have interviews and it's really well done. And they also have hotels in New York, LA, and Miami. If you don't have their app, One Night Standard, I recommend getting it. It has these spontaneous same night stays at incredible rates. It's like a lightning deals thing where they just open up rooms and you can get a really great rate at a room that I can attest is much nicer than the room I live in.
All right. Well, here's Aaron with Chip Kidd.
Welcome, Chip Kidd.
Thank you.
We're here at the Miami Dade College. You do so much work that usually when I open someone's Amazon page, I can tell what they're doing right now or what they're selling. And yours is like shooting into 19 different directions. So
just don't read any of the reviews.
What brings you to this book fair?
Well, officially what brings me to the book fair this year is a new book that I have out from Abrams called Only What's Necessary, Charles Schulz and the Art of Charles Schulz and Peanuts. But I had a book come out earlier this year in June called Judge This, which was done under the auspices of the TED Conference folks who started a book imprint with Simon and Schuster. So two very, very different projects.
So rewinding for people who may or may not be familiar with what you do. Right. I think many.
And I always assume they're not.
My general assumption would be that people are familiar with your work and not your name. That if you held up your top 10, people would be like, "Oh, I have that."
Right.
And but so it was funny. I brought up that I was doing this with my I have two co-hosts in the show, and one of them was said, "Wait, who's Chip Kidd?"
Yeah,
and the other one said, "Chip Kidd actually designed a book I did 10 years ago."
That's kind of my life. Like, there's a small niche of people in publishing who know who I am. And then there's basically everybody else. But if I say Jurassic Park, then they're like, "Oh, what did you do?" And I created that dinosaur image. And then they know that.
Normally, I would use qualify something with arguably, but I would say you are non-arguably the most high-profile book designer, book jacket designer of your, at least of your era. I don't know if there was like stars of different book design eras, but
yeah, it is a very niche thing. Like I could say, you know, Paul Rand, who I think was a pretty high-profile designer in the 20th century and did some amazing book covers, but he did, you know. He did the logo for IBM and he did the logo for Colorforms. And,
right.
And I do some design that is not book related, but not much.
Yeah. So. I'm interested because there's been a shift both at the magazine and book level in the last, let's say, 20 years that has been a massive upheaval. And people often on this show want to talk about it, but it's difficult to talk about because what books are from a perspective of the text has not changed a tremendous amount in the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. The text is still X number of words. You can lay it out. And even with magazines, you know, if you look at an article from the 70s and you look at an article, you know, feature article now, they're fairly similar. The packaging and format has changed dramatically. So in some ways, you have been at the center of the biggest upheaval in how books are packaged ever. How has your job changed in the last period?
Well, in the last 10 years, I get this question all the time. And, and just the way you phrase it, how has my job changed? Not at all.
Okay.
And I feel very fortunate about this. But my job is to take a piece of text, regardless of if it's, you know, fiction or nonfiction or a biography or poetry, and give it a face, basically. Give it some kind of visual representation that will hopefully, you know, represent that text in a respectful and interesting way, but also intrigue a reader. Yeah. So in that sense, as long as I'm doing what I'm doing, that's not going to change. Whereas, I mean, in the magazine world, we get into all of these factors that are going to make me sound like a snob. But, you know, magazines, by their very nature, are ephemeral. So you may save a certain issue of a magazine for some sort of reason, but you're not really meant to.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Or you may save it because you have a guilt feeling about not reading The New Yorker every week.
Right. And I work primarily in hardcover books, physical hardcover books. And by their nature, you're supposed to save them. And so I think that's, at least so far after 29 years, you know, I've managed to survive. And not that things haven't changed, obviously, for books, but really my job is the same, is to create a cover for this thing that people will have. Now, so far, I have designed one digital-only cover.
So when you shrink down that design to the Kindle or iPad postage stamp, the challenges of achieving the things that you're talking about for the reader seem to be upped.
Okay. All right. So now I go into all my sound bites.
Do you not want to? I'm curious. Is this is like something like I actually was thinking when I was writing this question. Probably he just doesn't want to talk about this anymore.
I'll talk about it if you want to talk about it and if you think your audience wants to,
we'll do the quick talk because there's other stuff that I'm actually more interested in. But I think it's a question a lot of people have about the book, which is the book being diminished in this format? And do you still have this, you know, is this a design challenge or just a shitty format?
Well, first of all, like if people want to buy a digital book, buy a digital book.
Yeah.
I'm not into it.
Yeah. I mean, I bought Judge This as a digital book on the plane here, and the illustrations are not on the same thing as the page.
Well, that's what I was saying. Like, Judge This has all of 6 reviews on Amazon, and 2 of them are to the basically say, you know, I bought the digital version of this book and it sucks.
Yeah.
And I have not even seen it. I don't want to see it.
Okay, I won't show you my phone.
Don't show me your phone. And when I signed a contract to do that book, part of it was they were going to do an ebook of it. I understood that. They are TED,
yep.
Technology, Entertainment, and Design. And if they want to do an ebook, then they can do an ebook. But it's also now my understanding that it's a mess,
yep.
which doesn't surprise me. My 2 novels, The Cheese Monkeys and The Learners, are very reliant on how they are set up typographically. And I have looked at those on the Kindle just, you know, long enough before I, you know, felt I wanted to puke because they totally break away. Even when I was in school, pre-computer, there's a reason that thumbnail sketches are called thumbnail sketches because they are small and they are distillations and they are supposed to be a simplification of the idea that you have. So that hasn't changed. Most graphic designers that I know sketch the stuff out small.
Yeah.
One of the other things was, I mean, I'm not big on graphic design rules, quote unquote, but well, I did a graphic design book for kids that came out about 4 years ago called Go. And one of the things in there is if you have an image or a design that looks good, really small, then when you blow it up to actual size, it's going to be far more effective.
Interesting.
Okay. So I've been mindful of how this stuff looks like as a postage stamp pretty much from the beginning. And part of that was also because way probably before you were born, there was something called the Book of the Month Club. And the Book of the Month Club used to buy a group ad on the back page of the New York Times Book Review every week where they showed as many of these goddamn books, all, you know, current bestsellers, postage stamp or sub-postage stamp size. And so it wasn't like I was ever told to design with that in mind, but it was always interesting to see how one of my designs would be reconfigured for this ad. And sometimes they would change it and take away some of the detail, or sometimes they would keep it.
Hey, I'm going to pause things here for a quick word from our sponsor, Prudential. I'm kind of a procrastinator. Perhaps you also are a procrastinator. And every time you're putting something off, whether it's work or the gym or saving for retirement, I want you to remember that you are not lazy. Our brains are hardwired to procrastinate. And the sooner you get that wiring reset and start saving for retirement, the better off you'll be down the line. So if you can visit bringyourchallenges.com, you'll learn more about procrastination and other behaviors that get in the way of saving more for retirement. Prudential has a lot of great info that can help you get a financial future which is secure. I recommend checking it out. Again, bringyourchallenges.com. Thanks, Prudential. Next up, The Great Courses. People who listen to this show will know I am a great fan of The Great Courses and video learning in general. They have a new product out there that I think people are going to be very excited about. It's called The Great Courses Plus. It's an unlimited buffet of every class they offer. Science, history, cooking. You can learn the fundamentals of photography filmed in partnership with National Geographic. All of this stuff at a single price, but that single price for the first month is zero. That's right, you can get a free month of access to everything The Great Courses Plus has to offer. That's hundreds of courses. So I want you to go to thegreatcourses.com plus, PLUS.com/longform. You'll get a free month and you'll be supporting the show. Thank you, The Great Courses Plus. Here I am back with Chip Kidd.
When you're dealing with like fiction, you know, someone's created a world and they're asking you to create a jacket to that world. Mm-hmm. When you're dealing with nonfiction, someone is already working within a certain constriction of fact. Mm-hmm. And then you're being asked to do a cover.
Mm-hmm.
Do you regard doing a nonfiction cover differently? Has anyone ever said, hey, this cover is not factually accurate to you?
Well, God, that's interesting. I mean, a current thing that has been approved but won't be out until the spring is a book by Lawrence Wright on terrorism.
Check out his long form podcast.
He's amazing.
I interviewed him at South by Southwest this year.
He's fantastic. I did the cover of The Looming Tower. And
oh, you did that cover?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's a great cover.
But the new book, The Terror Years, to me, the obvious thing would be to do a close-up of this sounds horrible, but of this guy, black hood, you know, slit for the eye from one of these horrible video, you know, like beheading videos.
Sure.
That specific thing, really, I couldn't find that it had been done the way I thought I would do it. So then I did the design, and there's this kind of hierarchy approval thing. I worked through his editor, a woman named Ann Close, who I've worked with forever. And so I show it to her, and then I show it to the editor-in-chief, and if they see fit, then they send it to him.
Mm.
And basically, the consensus was, it's too scary.
Was there an issue there? I'm just curious, like, about using an image of an actual terrorist versus stock art of someone
well,
in
you
that
know,
costume
that's
or a
really,
drawing.
Really good question, because I did a lot of research, and there's a lot of stock images of people who are dressed as terrorists who clearly are models dressed as
Halloween costumes gone horribly wrong.
Or whatever, but it's just obvious.
Yeah.
Because terrorism and terrorists by their very nature are not going to sit in a photo studio with perfect lighting.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that they don't want their image out there in a certain way, but it's not that way.
Yeah. If you just gave someone a bunch of photos, they would pick a news photo. They would pick something that had that grit and texture. But I'm thinking, particularly in a nonfiction book, at that point, you have to say, hey, that's Jihadi John on the cover. Like, that's a real terrorist.
Right.
This is a news photo.
Exactly.
So how do you deal with that? Is it?
Well, then you go back to the drawing board, and because you also need something, and this is very sort of like broad term and broad explanation, but you need something that's going to make, quote, a good cover.
Sure.
Which in my mind means certain formal considerations. There are all these photos of, you know, the results of terrorism but they don't make for a compelling, gee, I want to read that image. Then I found an image of a training camp where it was like looking down two columns of armed figures with hoods and what have you, and this was a real ISIS training camp. And so, you know, like formally, it was interesting because you're looking down these two columns, and they're sort of coming at you, but they're not aiming their guns at your face. They're training. Which is very clear. So everybody seemed to like that. And then Larry crowdsourced it, and someone wrote, this has been used before on another book.
Ooh.
Which I was not able to find, but somebody in the crowdsourcing found it. And so then I had to go back to the drawing board again.
Are you generally against the idea of crowdsourcing in design?
Oh, fuck yes. Am I allowed to say that?
Hey, this is a podcast.
Yeah,
do
that's what
twice.
I thought. Yeah, that's what I thought. You know, but fuck crowdsourcing.
Yeah.
But more to the point, fuck focus testing. One of the great things about the fact that there is no money in book publishing, unless you're Stephen King or something, is that we don't We can't afford to do focus testing.
A certain chicken and the egg factor there, where it's right. Like maybe we'd have the money if we like did more.
But nothing good comes of that. I mean, it's one thing for him to find out, you know what, this was used on another book about terrorism, and it's a significant enough book, at least in his mind, that we needed to do something different.
Yeah,
I totally get that. I understand it. As opposed to, I showed it to my wife and she didn't like it, you know, which is like, gee.
Is part of that exchange that when you ask someone for their opinion of something, that's a totally different thing than the subconscious first impression when you're in a bookstore or you're hearing about a book? I mean, are people kind of unable to articulate their true view of a design?
It all depends on who they are.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes some can and some can't. But one of my favorite things to say is the really, really great writers just let me do my job. And then there are the other writers. Haruki Murakami just lets me do whatever I want, which is not to say that I'm not mindful of his opinion and respect it, but it's just worked out that way.
Yeah. When the situation is reversed and you are writing the book, you're the author instead of the designer. Do you design all of your own books, or do you bring in other people to do it?
Well, I design them all, but I often bring it. Well, like with the novels, like with the Cheese Monkeys, I brought in Chris Ware. Mm. With the Learners, I brought in Charles Burns and Chris Ware. But it's me sort of orchestrating the whole thing. Wow. Like, I need...
You've got kind of a dream team. It's easy to let other people go when you've got a Charles Burns and a Chris Ware.
Well, but also I was very specific about what I wanted.
Yeah.
You know, I for Charles Burns, it's like, well, I sort of need... It's me, you know, it's extreme close-up, you know, from nose up through, you know, and I have to look really surprised and upset and sweating.
The cover of The Collected Black Hole is one of my favorite. The way he did that is beautiful.
Yeah, he's incredible.
So the reason I was asking you is this idea of a third party coming in and being part of your art sort of without necessarily true collaboration, but just kind of a trust me thing. Are you able to do that when you're the artist? Are you able to defer to someone else's vision in that way?
That hasn't really happened much.
You just don't put yourself in that situation.
Well, it happens when they go to a foreign edition and I'm simply not consulted. And the foreign edition comes out, and it's like, well, gee, that's interesting.
Almost all British editions of books look to me like they're like made in some weird cheap like factory where someone has to do 20 covers a day. Have you seen those Elena Ferrante books, the British editions of them?
I have gotten asked, I'd say over the last 3 or 4 months, this doesn't sound like much, but it's interesting. I get like an inquiry from the media once or twice a month to talk about the Ferrantes.
Really?
Yes. I have no opinion other than I haven't read any of the books.
Yeah.
So I can't speak about it that way. I look at these covers and I just think, well, they kind of look shitty to me, but...
I think they're going down as like the most inappropriate book covers ever.
They must be, because I get asked about this a lot. And I, for the most part, I just say, you know what? I don't have anything to say. All I can say is, and I haven't even said this, just literally at face value, I would never think that this was a serious writer.
Right. There's one thing, which is reading the book and conveying something of the text and the story or the ideas in it. And then there's these other sort of cultural ideas. Who's a serious writer and who's not a serious writer? Is this high or lowbrow? What section of the bookstore does this get filed in? Mm-hmm. How do you deal with those kind of concerns?
I either don't deal with them at all or deal with them subconsciously.
Mm.
I really try to give the potential reader as much credit as possible. if that makes any sense at
no,
all.
No, no. I mean, that's sort of a dying concept of giving people credit for more rather. I mean, that's sort of some of the stuff we're talking about functional design, mm-hmm. too. It's a question of how much credit you're giving a stranger. Is it a little bit more than average or a lot less than average?
Right. Well, I think Steve Jobs was probably a great believer in that. That when you look at the iPod, even the very first one, you know, it's all about intuition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't like any music playing device that you had ever seen, and you just kind of had to figure it out. You know, you spin your thumb around the wheel and scroll through stuff. Oh, okay. Now, sometimes that can get, you know, very frustrating, but you know, I think I put it in my kids' book, like one of the single worst pieces of design that exists and has existed for, I don't know, since basic cable, that we deal with every day is the TV remote. And if you have, you know, if you have a certain kind of TV and then you have a certain cable thing, you probably have two remotes.
Or at least
two to figure. Yeah. It's maddening. It's incredible that people are willing to settle for that, but they want to watch their show, so they figure out. But just figuring out how to turn on the television. I mean, it's ridiculous. Ridiculous.
When you entered this industry, did you say, I want to be a book designer or I want to be a designer and, hey, here, there seems to be a job available as
correct.
Books?
Second.
Okay. what other kinds of, like, what were the other things you might have ended up doing at that juncture?
Well, at the time, I studied and majored in graphic design at Penn State University from 1982 to 1986. So that really was the last era before computers.
Mm.
Point being, you know, it was a multidisciplinary field. There was corporate identity, posters, album covers. So we, you know, we studied all these different things that graphic designers do and make, and books were one of them, which I particularly loved. But I didn't, basically, my overall goal was to graduate, go to New York, and get a job doing graphic design. Beyond that, I had a completely open mind. And the first substantial job I was offered was as assistant to the art director at Alfred A. Knopf, and I thought, all right, let's give this a shot.
So when you see a person kind of where you were in 1982 to 1986, trying to become a designer, the set of possibilities has changed a lot. It's not LP covers now, it's apps and web design, right, and stuff right. like that. What do you say to someone like that? I mean, in a very quickly evolving industry.
Good luck. you know, it's I get this all the time, and again, mostly inquiries over email. Lots of students wanting advice, but. It's very hard for me to, like, part of doing that basic design book for kids is so that I don't have to like talk about it or articulate it or what it's like. Here's this book.
Yeah.
Read this book, and then you just go and you and good luck to you. But also, it's such a different world than when I was a design student. I have no interest in designing for the web. I have no interest in designing an app.
Yeah.
So in a lot of ways, I don't quite know what to tell them. I mean, that I think was part of the impetus of the Judge This book about, is what you're doing clear to your audience? And so the clarity is important for all this stuff that we really, really need. How do I navigate this website? How do I operate my TV remote? My computer's not working correctly. How do I fix that? And yet, in terms of my work, I'm much more interested in the mystery stuff.
Having done now, I'm guessing, over 1,000 book covers, do you have an exact count?
I don't have an exact count.
That's a shame. You can just make up a number now. And
I've been saying 1,200 for years.
Having done over 1,200 book covers as of 2003 and not counting since then, that sense of mystery, I'm wondering how it operates within repetition. Mystery within your own work and doing things that are new and not feeling like you've gotten into a cycle. How do you keep it fresh? And do you consider your every other book cover you've ever done when you're doing book covers?
I try not to rip myself off or other people or what have you. But I try to remain philosophical about it in terms of, if the writers are keeping it fresh, then I'll be able to keep it fresh.
And that's an issue for a writer, too. You know, as people go through book after book, not just, you know, am I writing about the same thing, but am I repeating the same formula of how I come up with ideas?
Right.
Do you switch up how you formulate ideas ever? Do you ever feel like you have to change the way that you work in order to produce different kinds of work?
I rely a lot on the subconscious. Mm. Which I think is really important. As in, you know, you have this particular assignment, you're stuck, you don't know what to do. And that's the other sort of luxury in book publishing, is that you our deadlines aren't, say, if you're working for a magazine. Mm.
Do you have techniques for accessing your own subconscious? I mean, you know, I've been in situations where I've been like, yeah, I just need to use my subconscious. Come on, subconscious, go! Like,
No. That's why it's called the subconscious. No, it started doing its own thing. I mean, I was totally stuck on Dress Your Family in Corduroy and Denim by David Sedaris, and I'd done a bunch of different things, and some of which I thought were okay, but none of which were approved. And then I was researching something else and came upon this naked Barbie doll. It's like, oh, okay. You know, you have to, it's one of the luxuries, I guess, or responsibilities of working on like 10 things at once, is that if you're stuck on one and you're researching something else, you may find the answer to the other thing while looking for the one thing.
How do you, when you've got this subconscious running and you kind of have a clear idea of where your subconscious is going, and then you meet someone else whose the book is from their subconscious, mm-hmm. and your two subconsciouses are kind of meeting for the first time, how do you try to sync up with another artist who has their ideas? What are those negotiations like, and what have you learned over time about them?
Well, it all depends. I mean, the curious thing about doing a book cover is that you're creating a piece of art, basically, which is in service to a greater piece of art, which is really dictating what you're going to do. So it's, you know, I may think I came up with the greatest design in the world, but if the author doesn't like it and doesn't think it works for what they did, they win. And I've got to start over.
And which is ironic, because you're probably the most powerful book cover designer going right
it's
now.
It's perceived even, that way. Which
even
just,
you have to just kind of let it go.
Baffles me. Yeah. I get stuff rejected left and right.
And how do you decide what you're gonna do? How do you decide which covers you're gonna do, which covers you're not gonna do?
Well, I've been on staff at Knopf for 29 years and counting. Yeah. So there are certain authors who I develop working relationships with, so it's assumed that when they have another book in the pipeline, that I will work on it. And Murakami is probably the current best example. I've been doing his jackets for 20 years. He's got it. So his next book, which will be out next fall, is a conversation between him and Seiji Ozawa about music. So it's,
that's great.
It's basically, and I, you know, I again, like my subconscious, I'm trying to figure out like how am I. Like, what is the hook here? I mean, I can see in my mind what it would, quote, normally look like. And I'm trying to think if I can bring some kind of interesting approach to it, and I don't know if I can.
The Murakami is interesting because on his fiction, you've gone everywhere.
Correct.
With the fiction. On the nonfiction is somewhat literal. The running book has a man running on the cover of it. The underground book,
I think it has him running.
Has him running. The underground book, I think, has the Tokyo subway map on the cover of it. So do you see taking a direction like that? Like when someone's coming in, oh, it's a conversation. Okay, this is not the fantastical Murakami.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm trying to. So I officially got this assignment, say, a week and a half ago, and I'll have to come up with a design shortly after the first of the year, I would say. You know, there's the obvious thing. We put a picture of each of them. I don't know if there's a picture of the two of them, but, you know, or a picture of each of them. And, you know, so do I just be really straightforward with this? Or do I try and give it some sort of conceptual spin? I don't know. But I also haven't read it yet.
That might help.
Right, exactly.
Last question. Mm-hmm. You've done this for 29 years.
Mm-hmm.
You've got many years ahead of you.
I hope so.
What do you hope to achieve going forward from here on out?
In a lot of ways, I'm just kind of making it up as I go along. I'd say around the year 2000, where I was able to grow my role, in addition to the book covers, to being an acquiring editor of graphic novels, comic books. And then beyond that, started writing books myself. So I always like to have at least one or two, quote, personal projects that I'm working on in addition to the other stuff. And I would just like to continue on with that. You know, the Peanuts book is the most recent one.
Thank you, Chip Kidd.
All right, thank you.
And that was the Longform Podcast. Thanks to my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Evan Ratliff. Thanks to Chip Kidd, who came in just off a flight. He's got great, great looking luggage, in case anyone is curious. Really nice luggage. Thanks to our editor, Jenna Weiss-Berman. Thanks to our intern, Molly Bain. Thanks to our sponsors, of course, MailChimp, as always, and The Standard, who brought me down for this interview. You can go to standardhotels.com, which is more of a magazine than a website for a hotel, and also get their app, One Night Standard, which has these great, like, limited-time deals where you can pick up a room way below the advertised rate. The Standard actually sponsored another episode, which we're going to put up Friday. That's a conversation with Alexander Heyman. Highly recommend that. Check back in a couple days for that. We'll be back then. Thanks.